Hello, I am Paige Albiniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. And in fact, it is the last Daily Brief podcast of 2019. So to escort the year out, I have with me one of my very favorite guests, Linda Ong. She is chief culture officer at Civic Entertainment, and she is here today to talk with me about the cultural trends she saw in 2019 and the trends she sees coming in 2020 and the overlap thereof. I always really love talking to Linda because she sees things in ways that just don't occur to me. So, and she and I haven't really gone over this, so everything she says to me will be just as surprising as it is to you guys who are listening. So hello, Linda. Welcome back.
Thank you, Paige. Thanks for having me.
It's always my extreme pleasure to have you. So let's dive right in. Start with number one. What is the number one culture? Or actually, I guess it'd be three and maybe you'd work your way back. But anyway, start with the first trend that you saw in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I think this might be the biggest one for certainly the year end of 2019, but we really saw 2019 usher in, especially in the entertainment world, this idea of messy women, which is women that are not only empowered, but they're incredibly flawed, as most of us are. We're all human, right? And so while we have our individual notable points and talents and empowerment and, you know, all those other great things that we want to be known for, this year, a lot of entertainment really did a deep dive into more psychological explorations of what was going on in women's lives. So you had, you know, I think notably Fleabag getting all the Emmy love in September, and really celebrating these really complicated, complex characters. Shows like Insecure, Russian Doll, Mrs. Fletcher at the end of the year, even The Crown, Princess Margaret becoming one of the most fascinating characters of that story. And you see that, you know, she was really a victim of circumstance. And the thing that's really interesting about messy women is that they really require a great deal of empathy, but it's not hard to get there. It's very, very relatable for a lot of women. And, you know, even a story, a film like Marriage Story with Scarlett Johansson and, you know, her making decisions that are best for her and maybe not best for her family, that just reflects the complications of real life.
Do you feel like at the end of 2019, I mean, I agree with you, and those are all great examples. And in fact, I just was rewatching Fleabag. But do you feel like, it's late to be like, oh, hey, women are complicated at the end of 2019.
Well, I think television is an expression of what's going on in society. And so I think that what, you know, a lot of the conversation post Me Too was about women being recognized for not, you know, for things that they had not been able to talk about before, or that they, where the power structure didn't allow for those kinds of conversations. And I think now that we've had, you know, I think 2 years of a very healthy and continuing conversation about Me Too, women are just anxious or eager to display other facets of their lives. And so it's interesting to explore in television what this all means. And I think, you know, this is part of a larger macro trend that we see of shifting the conversation in terms of character development in two ways. One, shifting from a lot of examinations of identity, which is, you know, different kinds of people and all the different ways there are to be, to, you know, from sort of the what of all the different identities to the why, and how do people think and what makes them tick and who are they deep down. So really seeing, you know, part of this exploration of messy women is really sort of a fascination in especially prestige entertainment to really look at psychology. And the other thing I would say is this mirrors the growing interest in culture and large in mental health. Those two things are really connected in our eyes.
It's I think it's interesting too, because I feel like premier television, probably television in general, but I think it's interesting culturally how what television is reflecting isn't necessarily what's being reflected politically. And by that I mean, you know, what at least half the country is sort of not into culturally. But on the TV side, you know, that's really going to the other end of the spectrum, where I feel like half the country politically wants to go in the other direction. So I think that's just an interesting divide to look at.
I mean, we definitely are seeing that increasingly premium content, prestige content is playing to the more progressive sensibilities of the country. But the country, despite the political situation overall, statistics show that the country is trending more progressively. It doesn't mean they're voting that way, but their ideas of, you know, what the country stands for in terms of values, there are certainly setbacks, but especially among younger generations, it is definitely trending more progressive. But I think premium prestige entertainment really reflect more progressive views, for sure.
Just for a time marker for people, I'll just say that Linda and I are recording this literally while the House is debating the impeachment vote.
Yeah. Not going to be much of a debate, but yes, voting. Yes.
I mean, it's a lot of talking up there, though. Yes. Of those, I'm just curious, of those shows that you mentioned and those complicated, messy women that you mentioned, which was your favorite?
That's really hard.
Oh,
no, I'm particular. Mrs. Fletcher is really, really, really interesting, because it's just so interior, and and I think I also really am loving The Crown this year, not just for the messy women, but just the incredible psychological examination of every character, which is really interesting. And you know, it used to be in the beginning, in the early days of television and film narrative, that the plot, the characters were really there to serve the plot. You know, storylines were very plot driven and the characters had to advance it. Now we're seeing a huge shift where the plot has to be in service of the characters. So if you look at a show like The Crown, where almost, I think with the exception of two episodes, every episode is essentially a bottle episode about different characters and different aspects of their lives, the timeline, the chronological and historical events are only there to motivate us to examine the psychology of these characters. So this is a real shift that we're seeing. And it's real. I think it's really fascinating. And you know, the character development is sort of the new world building, is what is the interior worlds, what are the interior worlds of these characters.
I deeply love The Crown. I just love it. It's so stunning.
Their podcast is really good too.
Yeah, actually, I've been listening, and let me recommend that to people, is The Crown has a podcast, a very nicely produced podcast about each episode. Yeah, I recommend people tune into that if you're into The Crown. All right, I could talk about messy women for 3 to 5 hours, but let's go on to the next thing.
I think the second thing we saw in 2019 that was really notable, and again, you know, of course, because times move and change so quickly, so a lot of this is more recent, but really the rise of Gen Z from a cultural perspective to really take the stage. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, we're living in times when there's now more millennials on the planet than boomers. And so youth has definitely hijacked the narrative, but now we see the Gen Zs are starting to grab the spotlight from the millennials. Gen Zs, if you think about it, on the high end are in their mid-20s, like 23, 24. So these kids are out of college, if they went to college, and starting to make their mark on the world. But, you know, everybody from Billie Eilish in the music world mm-hmm. to Greta Thunberg and the larger global stage have really gotten a lot of attention for, you know, a couple of things. One is this sort of new aesthetics, and that includes Billie's, you know, her musical style from a sonic perspective, but also visually the way she presents herself. And even in Instagram, you see, and TikTok, you see younger generations really pushing back on the Instagram aesthetic of very polished and photoshopped and, you know, really produced with a very high gloss to what we call aspirational realness, which is really kind of the more really unguarded, unvarnished, and certainly unretouched views of life that that they're really finding to be less pressure and more attainable and more interesting because they feel they can trust it a little bit more. But the other thing with people like Greta Thunberg is, you know, what we think she really stands for. Certainly, there's a lot of attention to climate change and the ramifications for future generations. But really, to us, what we see culturally is Greta stands for this radical idealism of youth, which is, you know, this ability to really stand up and call attention to things that are really idealistic values, but do it in a very activist way. It was interesting because I was at a conference in Stockholm this summer, and it was the first time I'd ever heard of Greta, and she spoke there, and she was legit scary, but in a good way. I mean, she was scary because of her youth and her conviction. You know, if somebody was my age getting up there and having that conversation, no one would have batted an eye. But the fact that she was angry because this is her future, she saw people squandering. So the fact that she's been able to garner as much attention as she has, even getting into a fight with the president of the U.S., you know, says a lot from a generational standpoint about, you know, how that generation is going to show up in the world.
How do you think that, or how do you see that Gen Xers, maybe boomers, but I'm sort of more interested in Gen Xers since I am one. How do you see that group relating to Gen Z and sort of integrating Gen Z into the way they understand the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. We made the observation that Gen X and Gen Z have a lot in common for different reasons, but they do have this rebellious kind of punk attitude towards the system and the establishment that is different than the way that boomers dealt with it. It's different than the way that millennials dealt with it. And it's much more radical. And I think part of what you're seeing in culture and even beyond Gen Z and Gen X, but just sort of this attitude that you know, the ways of protest and pushing back haven't really been that effective. It's not getting heard.
Yeah.
And so you see people like Jane Fonda intentionally getting arrested, right? Intentionally breaking the law to draw attention to issues that, you know, she thinks are important. And I think that, you know, that Gen Z spirit of radical idealism is really inspiring to other generations who are frustrated. And that's where a lot of that radical action comes from.
How do you think that, because Gen Z has both this access to and I think control of social media that other generations just, I just don't think they've had the complete immersion in it in the way that Gen Z has. How do you think that affects the way that they're communicating this out to the world?
That's a great point, because they really see that, you know, Gen Z sees the world through a social media lens. They are the first truly digital native generation. And so for them, everything starts with social. And everything, you know, it's interesting. We were talking to some clients recently, and we said, and they were aiming, their target audience was Gen Z. And we said, you cannot start with, like, what's the key art on the campaign? Because yeah, it's just like, we get that usually that requires the most media budget, and so that gets the most attention. But for Gen Z, their primary medium is always going to be social, and their paid media, if and when they see the key art, that will be an afterthought. And it really is upending, you know, how we should think about reaching audiences, because it's not even relevant. You know, key art's not relevant to them unless it's in a social post.
Yeah, I was going to say, unless it's on Instagram or something.
Yeah. And so, you know, starting with how do you see the world where you wake up every day, and we all do it, but, you know, truly, you know, wake up online, wake up through social, you know, what does that world look like, and how do you process information differently? So I think for marketers, it is, when they're trying to reach Gen Z, they really have to question their own biases about media and messaging.
I think it's interesting too, because social media allows the Gen Zers to create their own platform. Mm-hmm. So, and I can't speak to actually how Greta or Billie Eilish did that, but I do think it played a significant role in their ability to amplify their messages.
Yeah, I mean, it's something where they know that you know, from the get-go, they have a broadcast platform, essentially. It's just a new broadcast for them.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, yeah, and you don't, there's no barrier to entry, which is so interesting.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah. Like, and that must be a struggle, right? Like media companies having to cede that control. Not, I mean, they're not, but they are. You know, they don't have complete control over who comes up through social media and becomes.
Definitely don't have control.
Yeah.
And, that's, you know, I was talking to my analyst, Megan, and she was telling me about the number one person on TikTok. I don't remember the person's name, but how, you know, she's just incredibly normal. There's nothing remarkable about her. She gets up, sings and dances, but there's nothing remarkable. And people are just following her because she's so normal in a way. So, you know, those kinds of things fly in the face of what a lot of marketers are used to, which is differentiation and trying to figure out, you know, how to really stand out. And, you know, what's happening in TikTok is the people who are standing out are the people that are not standing out.
I have thus far managed to avoid TikTok, but I think that time is coming to an end. I'm like, I just sort of figured out Instagram, and now here comes TikTok.
I know. Keep up.
All right, number three.
Well, speaking of TikTok, I think, and this phenomenon of sort of normalness is we have seen in 2019 a real interest in what we call wholesomeness. So this, you know, not cynical, more supportive, embracing, but not necessarily soft view of the world that embraces, you know, ideas like play or Mr. Rogers or things that, you know, whether it's things on social media or products that, you know, just make you feel good, that I think this is really a reaction to the world being so challenged.
Let me just say that the wholesomeness thing is funny because, so shout out to Andres Trujillo, who is my producer, and to Kayla Marie Hardway, who's my digital content editor. And we recently had a whole conversation about wholesome. I mean, it's a word that they, I mean, they're both like 23 and 27, if I got your ages wrong, guys, sorry, but they're young, you know, and they, you know, that was a whole trend that we actually just talked about. And it's something that they pay attention to and notice.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's interesting. Times are really rough. So, you know, things that actually make you feel good. I mean, in fact, the whole nostalgia trend can really be also put under this category of wholesomeness, because from our perspective, what we see is nostalgia isn't about going back and wanting to sort of re-engage with artifacts. It's really about using those artifacts as triggers for reminding you of good feelings, right? Of happier times, of comfort. So, you know, wearing a scrunchie itself might be kitschy and fun, but actually it reminds you of a time when things were better and that you don't have to worry about, you know, all the anxieties of the current day world. So nostalgia in its sense, in that sense, has a very wholesome quality of allowing you to reminisce and be in a, and transport you into a safer space.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's a lot about safety.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody feels safe right now. I mean, it's a really scary world.
Yeah.
No,
and
globally.
Yeah. Yeah. When you mentioned scrunchy and when you were talking about aspirational realness, that idea of Visco Girls came to
mind. I knew that was going to come up.
Okay. I just wondered if you wanted to talk about that at all.
Well, I mean, we definitely see the Visco girl as a rejection of, again, influencer culture. And I think that, you know, Gen Z is very radical and very pointed in their rebellion. And so that's just a very visual way to do that. But it's very much about not wanting to take part in somebody else's game.
Tell my listeners what a Visco girl is.
Visco girl, well, it comes from, Visco comes from, VSCO comes from a company called Visual Supply Company, it's an app. And what a Visco girl does is adopt certain signifiers, like a scrunchie, a Hydro Flask bottle. There's certain things that you can tell what a Visco girl is and the way she dresses. And it's just really kind of a very subtle form of social protest.
That's interesting. Okay, let's move now to 2020. What do you see coming?
Well, contrary to the messy women of 2019, what we're really seeing in 2020 is the rise of really deep explorations and conversations and debates about masculinity. And this, of course, has to happen for a couple of reasons. In a post-Me Too world and in a woke world, a lot of questions of and confusion about what it means to be a man today and for some, you know, a straight white man in a time when those things were, the patriarchy was driven by those people. Now those questions are all, or that power is all has been put in question, and it's really confusing for a lot of men. On the upside, what it's really allowing men to do and giving them permission culturally to do is adopt ideas, values, and behaviors that used to be considered feminine. So, for example, one of the things we're looking at is this idea of male caring, being mm-hmm. a caregiver, and is mm-hmm. that how is that going to be explained and explored through entertainment and other avenues of culture? Because we also know that ever since the recession, more men are taking care of children in the home, more men are taking care of aging parents, and that has not been a traditional role for them. And so they're starting to reinvent that in a way where it's really redefining what it means to be manly, right? And you even see that in the beauty and grooming business, where, you know, the biggest growth in that sector right now is coming from men's skincare products. And the idea that men have to take care of their skin in ways that women have been doing for centuries is pretty new. And it's interesting, Old Spice has a commercial out right now with Dion Cole, and he's saying men have skin too. Almost like their kind of equality plea. mm-hmm. And, and you're seeing also a lot of mental health issues with men. As we know, sort of the plight of the straight white male has been linked to issues like school shootings and serial killers and things like that, that disenfranchisement. So shows like Barry are really great at exploring mm-hmm. The confusion of having to be a man today, Living with Yourself with Paul Rudd, which came out this year, both of those obviously this year, but we see we're working on a couple shows for 2020 that are exploring these topics head on. So we definitely think this is going to be a bigger conversation. The Atlantic just came out with a big cover story yesterday on masculinity. So I think for marketers really need to question how are they presenting men, and are they doing it in a way that's aligned with their audience's evolving notions of what it means to be a man today.
So two things on that. One, I have always wondered about men's skincare because like my husband does nothing and I don't understand. Like he doesn't even put lotion on his face, and that seems terrible to me. I don't get it. And then I think it's interesting because
part of their upbringing, you know, and actually what we found, we did a whole study, and what we found is men were actually very interested in it, but they were either afraid to ask or they didn't know. If you look at, to us, the greatest sort of role models in advanced masculinity in terms of like things like beauty and grooming and style are NBA players. Like they spend a lot of time taking care of themselves, how they look. And so, you know, there's that. But then for men, it's a form of self-care, which, as we know, was a huge trend for 2019 as well. And again, a reaction to the times we live in. And beauty and grooming just become an extension of self-care.
Yeah. So it's kind of part of it.
Give him some simple products for Christmas. I mean, there's entirely new lines that are coming out for men or are gender neutral that, you know, are very sort of low lift for men. It's actually proven that most men adopt skincare regimens for to achieve certain goals, like, you know, there's a wedding or there's a high school reunion or there's a job interview. But now more and more men are just doing it as a daily habit.
It just seems uncomfortable to me to go through life with no moisturizer. I feel like, how are you living that way?
The other thing is facial for Christmas.
Okay, maybe. the thing I was going to say is I've been going through and, like I said, doing these year in review stories, and the one thing that keeps coming up is the Gillette ad.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was pretty early in the year.
The problem with the ad is that, you know, the other thing, and then now we're going back to 2019, but mm-hmm. over the last couple of years, and I've done Promex sessions on this, that this idea that you are a brand is not just about what you're putting out messaging wise to the external world, but it's like, how do you walk the talk internally, right? And the issue mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. Gillette was that people didn't feel that they really had the right to be trying to push back on notions of masculinity when their company didn't reflect that commitment as well. And, you know, one of the biggest issues about masculinity right now is this fact that while a lot of companies have gotten very progressive about offering paternity leave and family leave, most, I think the higher percentage of men don't actually take it, and certainly at the higher levels. And so what's happening is it's great if you have a family leave policy that's very progressive, but if your senior male executives are not taking it, they're not modeling the behavior for the rest of the organization. Mm-hmm. So that's something that, you know, we're looking in 2020 to see more of a push to have men actually take their leave.
Yeah, I mean, I think that conversation about brand purpose and how it has to sort of, you know, start at the beginning, right,
yeah,
and be woven through the company fabric in order for it to project correctly onto the world is always a strong point.
Right.
Know.
Sorry about that.
Let's asterisk something I want to ask you about before we wrap up, but
okay,
we'll do it at the end.
Is the dog bothering you? Because I can put him in another room.
I mean, it's okay.
Okay.
Anyway, what I was going to say is put an asterisk on the Peloton ad, because I want to talk to you about that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, we can talk Peloton.
Okay, so let's go to the next thing. That first one was masculinity for 2020. Okay. Let's go to the next thing.
The second point on 2020 trends we're looking at would be this idea of existentialism. We're seeing the beginnings of a lot more explorations of, why am I here? What am I doing with my life? You know, and a lot of this is, again, because of this framework of this crazy, messed up world that we live in, and where it's very difficult for people to feel any kind of control over their lives. And so in that situation, there is a lot of internal, deep diving and navel gazing. And we see this in a number of different areas in culture, which you probably have seen over the past year or two. But, you know, they're really kind of coming to sort of more of a collective feeling of existentialism. And those would be like alternative spirituality. We see the rise of these alternative churches like Mosaic and Hillsong, and people, as we've seen a decline in formal organized religion through the years, now we see a rise in these alternative ways of being and thinking. And that has also connections to the wellness movement and self-care, right? Because these are things that people actually feel they can maybe control. Mm-hmm. And there's also a huge rise in interest in horoscopes and astrology. And that's an alternative form of faith. And again, it's this more optimistic view that maybe there is a reason that all these things are happening, even if we don't control them or don't entirely understand them. But sort of this appreciation that if you have a bad day and you can read in your horoscope, there's a reason that you're having a bad day. It just sort of makes you feel better. And the other more kind of millennial Gen Z view of existentialism is, they're living in a time right now of extreme optimism and extreme nihilism at the same time. And these factors are not working against each other. They're actually collaborating together. And so this is an era where we see a lot of that kind of, again, existential questions about, you know, what things are separate, what things are blended. You even see this in a lot of genre blurring that we've been seeing over the years, or even, again, like Billie Eilish and her music. So this idea of just kind of questioning ways of being, you know, the existence of individuals or humanity, these are big, meaty kind of questions that are being explored in a number of different trends, but they really all kind of ladder up into people trying to, again, really seek meaning in the world. And we see that really becoming more and more of a thing in 2020.
Where do you see, I mean, Fleabag comes to mind again, but where else do you see that kind of popping up in pop culture?
I think we see it less in, I think we're going to see it more in entertainment, but I think in pop culture, it's really the spirituality and wellness craze that's been largely a consumer craze, becoming much more about ideology. We see, you know, people taking wellness retreats and trying to live off the grid and, you know, really in kind of a, you know, Thoreau-esque kind of exploration of what it means to be alive today. So
partly a rejection of the digital.
Yeah, which actually
lifestyle.
Is my third category.
Oh, okay. Move into it.
Before we get there, it is really the sort of, but it is a desire to sort of reconnect with yourself, right? And so, yes, it's a rejection of something, but it is really an opportunity to say, well, who am I? And again, in a very sort of Thoreau-esque way, you know, ask these existential questions in a time when it just really seems like the, you know, the right questions to ask.
Do you, okay, I'm going to ask this question and I'm going to put a warning on it that I'll try to be delicate about this question, not so much for you, but for the listening audience, which is
a trigger warning.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a trigger warning, everyone. Do you think, I mean, also because it's political, but, you know, I feel like because the right has sort of co-opted evangelical Christians, so it's turned Christianity into something that becomes kind of a trigger word for progressives, and it makes it feel maybe like not a safe space for millennials, Gen Zers. So they're seeking the answers to these questions, which, you know, I think is sort of part of the human condition. So they're seeking the answers to these questions in other places. But do you think that's part of what's influencing this?
I think it's definitely part of it. I mean, the political discourse right now is incredibly alienating to a lot of youth.
Yeah.
As they see it as a legacy establishment issue, not a constructive way to move forward.
Right.
It doesn't really make sense. I mean, I think the biggest challenge in 2020 from a political standpoint is getting youth to turn out because they actually don't have faith that it matters.
Yeah.
And the candidates that they're really supporting, the more extreme, you know, extreme left candidates are probably not able to win a national election. So again, it becomes sort of like, what's the point?
Right. Right.
That's challenging.
Okay, so number three, which you already sort of partly unveiled, but...
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we've had, what, 20 years of a good run with tech and, you know, Facebook sort of coming to the fore in 2006 and really kind of launching the last 15-year run of excitement over new platforms, new revenue, new ways of communicating. And in 2019, you know, a lot of those things started crashing down in terms of privacy and surveillance and congressional hearings.
Yeah.
I think 2020, you're going to just start seeing that take on more and more forms. And it's interesting that the creators of Silicon Valley said, you know, one of the reasons they really wanted to end the run of the show was because the tech environment had changed so much. It was not a raucously joyous and, you know, unicorn promoting industry anymore. And in fact, you know, you saw people that came out of that era really falling very hard. Even a company like WeWork, which wasn't really a tech company, but kind of promoted itself in that, you know, they greatly benefited from that bubble.
Yeah.
You know, everything that happened with Adam Newman, you know, made it very difficult for people to believe in that kind of spirit anymore. So I think it'll be interesting as we see the fallout in 2020 of how people treat tech companies, especially in entertainment, less perhaps as role models and saviors and perhaps more as perpetrators of dark deeds.
I mean, that's really interesting in light of, I could think of a whole bunch of examples. So Facebook, for one, you know, the whole thing with Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes.
Oh.
what you just said about WeWork and Adam Neumann, and I don't know if people are familiar, but he just lived this very extravagant, lavish, money-spending lifestyle for no real benefit of the company.
And then, you know, thousands of people got laid off, and he got a nice big package.
Right.
You know, and again, you go back to companies living their values.
And his, yes.
You know, the WeWork mantra, the vision statement, was to elevate the world's consciousness. You know, so I think that you're going to see a lot more scrutiny on tech companies and from the entertainment business as well. Not look at them as sort of the golden children of business anymore, but to be much more critical. And I think issues of privacy and surveillance, which have always been lurking underneath, but people really haven't had to deal with them so much. I mean, now the issues are, you know, people's Nest cameras getting hacked into or Ring cameras mm-hmm. getting hacked into and people being surveilled by their TVs and things like that. And the Big Brotherness, which again has always been a threat, now is, you know, every day you see more and more examples of where people are more concerned about that. So, you know, Black Mirror is kind of really coming to a head. And I think the biggest challenge for Black Mirror is to stay ahead.
Yeah, completely. The other example I was going to throw out was the whole Fyre Festival thing, which I think around the middle of the year, that's when those documentaries came out. And to me, that was interesting on lots of levels, but one of the really interesting pieces was how successfully and effectively they leveraged digital marketing to drive that event, even though there was no there.
Yeah, I mean, now people are satirizing it, you know.
Yeah. And totally. Well, Silicon Valley, which you just mentioned.
It's interesting because we saw a pitch and it was totally unironically, couched in this idea like, we're going to market it like Fyre Festival. And we're like, great, if it's a parody, you know. And so people are, again, sort of like that backlash against the Instagram aesthetics. It is. And Gen Z certainly is way more cynical about marketing, and millennials, have also always been very cynical about it, but then they fueled a lot of the influencer marketing. So I think Gen Z is going to be way harsher on that kind of activity than anybody else. But mm-hmm. I think ultimately Gen Z really sees the world through the lens of, I mean, again, going back to existentialism, they don't actually know that there's going to be a world for them to live in, or they don't know what kind of world it's going to be, and they're very afraid.
Okay, it's a weird note for me to do this, Vera, but I'm going to do it. Let's talk about, I just wanted to get your take on the whole arc of what happened with the Peloton ad.
Oh, yeah. Talk about existential. Well, so Peloton does a piece of content, which apparently they've done similar pieces in the past, but somehow this one got more visibility, that was essentially a man gifting his very thin and fit already wife a Peloton. And what they didn't do, which would have been an easy solve, and it's easy to, you know, sort of retroactively criticize somebody's creative, because God forbid anybody do that to anything you do. But, you know, in retrospect, if they had started the piece with the wife or the girlfriend saying, you know, I really wish I could get a Peloton, or I'm really trying to do, you know, I have some fitness goals or whatever. If they could establish that it was her desire to have the Peloton, I think it would have not had the backlash that it did, although it probably would have still had some. We'll talk about that in a second. But what happened was the mere act of the premise being that the husband was gifting the wife a Peloton that they had not previously established that she wanted felt very quote unquote male gaze to people, that it was a man trying to tell his wife to be, you know, to lose weight or to be more fit or whatever. And it felt very not of her agency. So that was number one. Number two, the fact that she was very fit and very toned struck people as a 1% problem, right?
Yeah.
And that unrealistic. And why does she need to get more fit? Because she's already, like, are we body shaming her that she feels fat?
Although, flip side, I think if they would have put a heavier woman in the spot, it would have been even worse.
who knows? I can only respond to what, you know, the criticism was. But people did not like that she obviously, or she didn't, there was no obvious reason why he needed to get her this bike, and that maybe he was trying to make her feel bad about her appearance or whatever, or that she already felt bad. And then thirdly, it just, the 1%-ness of the whole thing, even though it's an extremely expensive piece of equipment, it just pissed off a lot of people who just felt like this is something that needed to be made in a more accessible manner and, you know, not be so lofty. So, you know, you can pick and choose which argument or arguments you agree with or don't agree with, but this was essentially the backlash. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that the takeaway for us was, and it's really our business, is like, how do you properly anticipate what the cultural response is going to be to a piece of content, right? What mm-hmm. are, it's not to say you can please everybody, because you can't, and we say that to our clients, but we also say, who are you willing to piss off, right? And so I think that the Peloton has said they don't care about this. Their stock price cared, right? Their price went down, you know, a huge amount in the day of the backlash, but I think it's since come back up. So I think really that's the lesson, and I think especially for people who are luxury marketers, they're going to have to be a little more mindful about, you know, what their placement is. And we've seen a lot of brands, especially in the fashion space, be the ones that really misstep the most because mm-hmm. they're so used to marketing in their 1% bubble. So I think the lesson is, certainly for all marketers, is to sort of be conscious of, you know, how your content is going to be perceived, because when you put it on social media, that is not a niche medium.
Right.
And so you sort of are invite, if your audience is a 1% audience, but you're putting something on the biggest social media platforms, you have to be ready to get criticism from people who are not your audience and don't like your message and maybe don't like your product. But I think certain things, you know, in terms of looking at a piece of content from what's the gender POV, what's the income POV, you know, the class POV, what's the racial POV, and just sort of being prepared for all those conversations, I think that's really the lesson.
Do you recommend people like that run it through those filters, like focus group it?
I don't think you have to focus group it. I mean, honestly, it's what our business is really helping people understand what some of the potential watch outs are and what they should lean into and how they should, you know, present and position their ideas in culture so that they're aligned with how culture wants to hear messaging.
The one flip side that I think has been interesting about this Peloton ad is its long tail, meaning, so, you know, Ryan Reynolds and Aviation Gin tapped that actress to be in a follow-up ad, which is sort of a parody of the original Peloton ad. And then I guess she just got cast in The Bold and the Beautiful. Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, I feel like Peloton Peloton could argue that they benefited. Like, people talked about Peloton for 2 weeks, probably.
Yeah. You know, did it sell more Pelotons? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that what people are looking for today, what we see is that people are very, you know, we live in a cancel culture, right? And they're very quick to call out missteps. And so I think they're today are just kind of some simple questions to ask yourself about, is your intent for the audience, you know, A, what's the right medium or media to reach that audience? Because if you have a very niche message and you put it on a broadcast platform, and when I say broadcast, I mean like social media platform, then, you know, you cannot control who sees your content. And everybody wants stuff to go viral, but viral means that people who are not necessarily aligned with your brand or your values or your audience have the opportunity to weigh in. And I think right now there are so many hungry observers just ready to call out tone deafness when it comes to, you know, living in a post-woke culture. I use woke in quotes. That it's, you know, it's just kind of prudent to put your content through those filters. Or, but I wouldn't necessarily focus group it, but I think, you know, having a cultural advisor or culture whisper, as we like to position ourselves, is, you know, just a smart disaster check.
You know, and just thinking about this too, you know, there's that saying, there's no such thing as bad PR, but I do think, you know, it's sort of, it puts a mark on the Peloton brand. It makes a little bit of a joke. It makes it sort of an emblem of this.
Yeah, I mean, I would make it analogous. I would make an analog, draw an analog to the Kendall Jenner Pepsi ad.
Totally.
And it's just, I think what you don't, you're 100% right. I think what you want to avoid as a marketer is, you know, sort of a large percentage of the population saying, what were they thinking? Because that actually reflects badly on the management of the company, right? Mm-hmm. So when the Pepsi Kendall Jenner ad came out, sort of the idea that nobody thought it was a bad idea was confounding to people, right? And so I think with Peloton, it was some of that too, is that, you know, what women on the management team thought this was a good idea, right? And how were they so blind to how this would be seen? And I mean, ultimately what it just points out to is a misalignment with culture. And so, you know, does that hurt a brand? Well, I think it can hurt a brand that purports to be very culturally aligned, like Peloton.
Yeah.
I mean, Peloton is supposed to be a cultural leader, right? In emergent tech, and, you know, again, it sort of comes back to then that backlash on tech. It's like, you're not as advanced as we thought you were.
Well, also, does it make people say, you know, if your workout regime is I use my Peloton, do people think, you know, it doesn't have the same brand sheen as maybe it once did?
Probably now it's become a little bit of a punchline.
Right, exactly.
But I mean, people I know who are Pelotons love it, and they're not fazed by this. They're not fazed by it. But, you know, potential new purchasers might be.
Well, you know, secretly and now not so secretly, do I want a Peloton? Yes, but that's okay.
Your husband.
Yeah, I'll get him some skin cream, and he can buy me a $3,000 Peloton bike.
There you
that's
go.
Cool.
I love it. Done. Shopping
done.
List done.
Exactly. Okay. I think that brings us to the natural conclusion. Linda, thank you so much. As always, you're amazing. We appreciate it.
It's fun. Thanks for calling me.
My pleasure. We will talk again soon, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, Paige.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks.
Paige Albaniak is editorial director of Promax. Andres Trujillo, Promax's social media and community manager, produced this podcast. Video Helper provides the music. Digital content producer Kayla Marie Hardaway contributes to Daily Brief. Promax has rebranded to just Promax, so you can find us on Promax Global on Facebook and Promax_Global on Twitter and Instagram. You can also always reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org, and you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.